This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Whistling Vivaldi, Issues of Our Time, and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. Written by Claude M. Steele. Narrated by DeMario. Chapter 1. An Introduction at the Root of Identity. 1. I have a memory of the first time I realized I was black. It was when at 7 or 8, I was walking home from school with neighborhood kids on the last day of the school year, the whole summer in front of us, and I learned that we black kids couldn't swim at the pool in our area park except on Wednesday afternoons. And then on those summer Wednesdays, with our swimming suits wrapped tightly in our towels, we filed, caravan style, out of our neighborhood toward the hallowed pool in the adjoining white neighborhood. It was a strange weekly pilgrimage. It marked the racial order of the time and place, Chicagoland, the 1950s and early 1960s. For me, it was what the psychologist William Cross calls an encounter with the very fact that there was a racial order. The implications of this order for my life seemed massive. A life of swimming only on Wednesday afternoons? Why? Moreover, it turned out to be a portent of things to come. I next found out that we black kids, who, by the way, lived in my neighborhood and who had been, until these encounters, just kids, couldn't go to the roller rink except on Thursday nights. We could be regular people, but only in the middle of the week. These segregations were hard to ignore, and mistakes were costly, as when, at 13, after arriving at 6 in the morning, I waited all day to be hired as a caddy at an area golf course, only to be told at the end of the day that they didn't hire Negroes. This is how I became aware I was black. I didn't know what being black meant, but I was getting the idea that it was a big deal. With decades of hindsight, I now think I know what was going on. I was recognizing nothing less than a condition of life, most important, a condition of life tied to my race, to my being black in that time and place. The condition was simple enough. If I joined the caravan and went to the pool on Wednesday afternoons, then I got in. If I went to the pool any other time, then I didn't get in. To my 7 or 8 year old self, this was a bad condition of life. But the condition itself wasn't the worst of it. For example, had my parents imposed it on me for not taking out the garbage, I wouldn't have been so upset. What got me was that it was imposed on me because I was black. There was nothing I could do about that, and if being black was reason enough to restrict my swimming, then what else would happen because of it? In an interview many years later, a college student, whom you will meet later in this audiobook, would describe for me an experience that took a similar form. He was one of only 2 whites in an African-American political science class, composed of mostly black and other minority students. He, too, described a condition of life. If he said something that revealed an ignorance of African-American experience or confusion about how to think about it, then he could well be seen as racially insensitive. Or worse, if he said nothing in class, then he could largely escape the suspicion of his fellow students. His condition, like my swimming pool condition, made him feel his racial identity, his whiteness in that time and place, something he hadn't thought much about before. From experiences like these, troubling questions arise. Will there be other conditions? How many? And how many areas of life? Will they be about important things? Can you avoid them? Do you have to stay on the lookout for them? When I encountered my swimming pool restriction, it mystified me. Where did it come from? Conditions of life tied to identity like that still mystify me. But now I have a working idea about where they come from. They come from the way a society, at a given time, is organized around an identity like race. That organization reflects the history of a place, as well as the ongoing individual and group competition for opportunity and the good life. The way Chicagoland was organized around race in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the rigid housing segregation, the de facto school segregation, the employment discrimination, and so on, meant that black people in that time and place had many restrictive conditions of life tied to their identity, perhaps the least of which was the Wednesday afternoon swimming restriction that so worried my 7 or 8 year old self. This audiobook is about what my colleagues and I call identity contingencies, the things you have to deal with in a situation because you have a given social identity, because you are old, young, gay, a white male, a woman, black, Latino, politically conservative or liberal, diagnosed with bipolar disorder, a cancer patient, and so on. Generally speaking, contingencies are circumstances you have to deal with in order to get what you want or need in a situation. In the Chicagoland of my youth, in order to go swimming, I had to restrict my pool going to Wednesday afternoons. That's a contingency. In his African-American political science class, my interviewee had the added pressure that his ignorance could cause him serious disapproval. That, too, is a contingency. What makes both of these contingencies identity contingencies is that the people involved had to deal with them because they had a particular social identity in the situation. Other people in the situation didn't have to deal with them, just the people who had the same identity he had. This audiobook examines the role these identity contingencies play in our lives, in the broader society, and in some of society's most tenacious problems. Now, of course, ours is an individualistic society. We don't like to think that conditions tied to our social identities have much say in our lives, especially if we don't want them to. We have a creed. When barriers arise, we're supposed to march through the storm, picking ourselves up by our bootstraps. I have to count myself a subscriber to this creed. But this audiobook offers an important qualification to this creed, that by imposing on us certain conditions of life, our social identities can strongly affect things as important as our performances in the classroom and on standardized tests, our memory capacity, our athletic performance, the pressure we feel to prove ourselves, even the comfort level we have with people of different groups. All things we typically think of as being determined by individual talents, motivations, and preferences. The purpose of this audiobook is nothing less than to bring this poorly understood part of social reality into view. I hope to convince you that ignoring it, allowing our creed of individualism, for example, to push it into the shadows, is costly to our own personal success and development, to the quality of life in an identity-diverse society and world, and to our ability to fix some of the bad ways that identity still influences the distribution of outcomes in society. How do identity contingencies influence us? Some constrain our behavior down on the ground, like restricted access to a public swimming pool. Others, just as powerful, influence us more subtly, not by constraining behavior on the ground, but by putting a threat in the air. 2. At the center of this audiobook is a particular kind of identity contingency, that of stereotype threat. I believe stereotype threat is a standard predicament of life. It springs from our human powers of intersubjectivity, the fact that as members of society, we have a pretty good idea of what other members of our society think about lots of things, including the major groups and identities in society. We could all take out a piece of paper, write down the major stereotypes of these identities, and show a high degree of agreement in what we wrote. This means that whenever we're in a situation where a bad stereotype about one of our own identities could be applied to us, such as those about being old, poor, rich, or female, we know it. We know what people could think. We know that anything we do that fits the stereotype could be taken as confirming it. And we know that, for that reason, we could be judged and treated accordingly. That's why I think it's a standard human predicament. In one form or another, be it through the threat of a stereotype, about having lost memory capacity, or being cold in relations with others, it happens to us all, perhaps several times a day. It is also a threat that, like the swimming pool restriction, is tied to an identity. It is present in any situation to which the stereotype is relevant, and this means that it follows members of the stereotyped group into these situations like a balloon over their heads. It can be very hard to shake. Consider the experience of Brent Staples, now a columnist for the New York Times, but then a psychology graduate student at the University of Chicago, a young African-American male dressed in informal student clothing walking down the streets of Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood. In his own words, "I became an expert in the language of fear. Couples locked arms or reached for each other's hands when they saw me. Some crossed to the other side of the street. People who were carrying on conversations went mute and stared straight ahead as though avoiding my eyes would save them. I'd been a fool. I'd been walking the streets grinning, good evening at people who were frightened to death of me. I did violence to them by just being. How had I missed this? I began to avoid people. I turned out of my way into side streets to spare them the sense that they were being stalked. Out of nervousness, I began to whistle and discovered I was good at it. My whistle was pure and sweet, and also in tune. On the street at night, I whistled popular tunes from the Beatles and Vivaldi's Four Seasons. The tension drained from people's bodies when they heard me. A few even smiled as they passed me in the dark. Chapter 1. Staples was dealing with the Phantom, a bad stereotype about his race that was in the air on the streets of Hyde Park, the stereotype that young African-American males in this neighborhood are violence-prone. People from other groups and other situations might face very different stereotypes about lacking math ability rather than being violence-prone, for example, but their predicaments would be the same. When they were in situations where those stereotypes could apply to them, they understood that one false move could cause them to be reduced to that stereotype, to be seen and treated in terms of it. That stereotype threat, a contingency of their identity in these situations. Unless, as Staples discovered, they devised a way to deflect it. Staples whistled Vivaldi, by his own account a very good version of it. What would that do for him? Would it improve his attitude toward others on the street? Make him more understanding? Probably not. What it did for sure was change the situation he was dealing with. And how it did this illustrates nicely the nature of stereotype threat. In a single stroke, he made the stereotype about violence-prone African-American males less applicable to him personally. He displayed knowledge of white culture, even high white culture. People on the street may not have recognized the Vivaldi he was whistling, but they could tell he was whistling classical music. This caused him to be seen differently, as an educated, refined person, not as a violence-prone African-American youth. Such youths don't typically walk down the street whistling classical music. While hardly being aware of it, people drop the stereotype of violence proneness as the lens through which they see him. He seems less threatening. People don't know who he is, but they know he isn't someone to fear. Fear fades from their demeanor. Staples himself relaxes. The stereotype in the air that threatened him is fended off, and that change in the behavior of those on the street and in his own behavior reveals the power that a mere stereotype, floating in the air like a cloud, gathering the nation's history, was having on everyone all along. Whistling Vivaldi is about the experience of living under such a cloud. An experience we all have, and the role such clouds play in shaping our lives and society. 3. Suppose you are invited into a psychology laboratory and asked to play 10 holes of golf on a miniature course that has been set up in a small room. Suppose also that you are a white college student, reasonably athletically inclined. Now suppose that just as you are getting the feel of the golf clubs, you are told that the golf task is part of a standardized sports psychology measure called the Michigan Athletic Aptitude Test, MAAT, which measures natural athletic ability. How well do you think you'd do? Would being told that the golf task measures natural athletic ability make a difference? A group of social psychologists at Princeton University, led by Jeff Stone, did exactly this experiment several years ago. They found something very interesting. White students who were told the golf task measured natural athletic ability golfed a lot worse than white students who were told nothing about the task. They tried just as hard, but it took them, on average, 3 strokes more to get through the course. What was it about thinking of the task as a measure of natural athletic ability that so strikingly undermined their performance? Jeff and his colleagues reasoned that it had something to do with their being white. In the terms I have been using, it had to do with the contingency of white identity that comes to bear in situations where natural athletic ability is being evaluated. This contingency comes from a broadly known stereotype in the society that, compared with blacks at least, whites may have less natural athletic ability. Participants in Jeff's experiment would know this stereotype simply by being members of this society. They might not believe it, but being told that the golfing task measured the very trait their group was stereotyped as lacking just before they began the task could put them in a quandary. Their frustration on the task could be seen as confirming the stereotype, as a characterization both of themselves and of their group, and this in turn might be upsetting and distracting enough to add an average of 3 strokes to their scores. The stereotype about their group and the threatening interpretation of their golf frustration that it posed is not a contingency like the swimming pool restriction of my youth that directly affected behavior. It imposed no extra restrictions on their golfing or any material impediments, but it was nonetheless a contingency of their identity during the golf task. If they experienced frustration at golf, then they could be confirming, or be seen to be confirming, the unsavory stereotype. If they didn't experience frustration at golf, then they didn't confirm the racial stereotype. This was an extra pressure they had to deal with during the golfing task, for no other reason than that they were white. It hung over them as a threat in the air, implying that one false move could get them judged and treated as a white kid with no natural athletic ability. You will learn later in the audiobook how my colleagues and I came to call this kind of threat in the air simply stereotype threat. With this reasoning in tow, Jeff and colleagues started asking more questions. If the mere act of telling white Princeton students that their golfing measured natural athletic ability had caused them to golf poorly by distracting them with the risk of being stereotyped, then telling black Princeton students the same thing should have no effect on their golfing since their group isn't stereotyped in that way. And it didn't. Jeff and his colleagues had put a group of black Princeton students through the same procedure they'd put the white students through, and lo and behold, their golfing was unaffected. They golfed the same whether or not they'd been told the task measured natural athletic ability. Here was more evidence that what had interfered with white students' golfing, when it was seen to measure natural athletic ability, was a distracting sense of threat arising from how whites are stereotyped in the larger society. But Jeff and his research team weren't satisfied. They devised a still cleverer way to make their argument. They reasoned that if group stereotypes can really set up threats in the air that are capable of interfering with actions as concrete as golfing for entire groups of people, like the stereotype threat Staples had to contend with on the streets of Hyde Park, then it should be possible to set up a stereotype threat that would interfere with black students golfing as well. All they'd have to do was represent the golfing task as measuring something related to a bad stereotype of blacks. Then, as black participants golfed, they'd have to fend off, like whites in the earlier experiment, the bad stereotype about their group. This added pressure might hurt their golfing. They tested this idea in a simple way. They told new groups of black and white Princeton students that the golf task they were about to begin was a measure of sports strategic intelligence. This simple change of phrase had a powerful effect. It now put black students at risk, through their golfing, of confirming or being seen to confirm the ancient and very bad stereotype of blacks as less intelligent. Now, as they tried to sink their putts, any mistake could make them feel vulnerable to being judged and treated like a less intelligent black kid. That was a heavy contingency of identity in this situation indeed, which might well cause enough distraction to interfere with their golfing. Importantly, the same instruction freed white students of stereotype threat in this situation, since whites aren't stereotyped as less intelligent. The results were dramatic. Now the black students, suffering their form of stereotype threat during the golfing task, golfed dramatically worse than the white students, for whom this instruction had lifted stereotype threat. They took, on average, 4 strokes more to get through the course. Neither whites, when the golfing task was represented as a test of natural athletic ability, nor blacks, when it was represented as a test of sports strategic intelligence, confronted a directly interfering contingency of identity in these experiments, nothing that directly affected their behavior, like a swimming pool restriction. The contingencies they faced were threats in the air, the threat that their golfing could confirm, or be seen to confirm, a bad group stereotype as a characterization of their group and of themselves. Still, it was a threat with a big effect. On a course that typically took between 22 and 24 strokes to complete, it led whites to take 3 more strokes to complete it, and blacks to take 5 more strokes to complete it. At first glance, one might dismiss the importance of something in the air, like stereotype threat. At second glance, however, it's clear that this threat can be a tenacious force in our lives. Staples had to contend with it every time he walked down the streets of his own neighborhood. White athletes have to contend with it in each competition, especially against black athletes. Think of the white athlete in a sport with heavy black competition. To reach a high level of performance, say, to make it into the National Basketball Association, which is dominated by black players, the white athlete would have to survive and prosper against a lifelong gauntlet of performance situations loaded with this extra race-linked threat. No single good athletic performance would put the stereotype to rest. The effort to disprove it would be Sisyphean, reemergent at each important new performance. The aim of this audiobook is not to show the stereotype threat is so powerful and persistent that it can't be overcome. Quite the contrary. Its goal is to show how, as an unrecognized factor in our lives, it can contribute to some of our most vexing personal and societal problems, but that doing quite feasible things to reduce this threat can lead to dramatic improvements in these problems. 4. Now suppose it wasn't miniature golf that you were asked to perform when you arrived at a psychology experiment, and suppose it wasn't your group's athletic ability that was negatively stereotyped in the larger society. Suppose it was difficult math problems that you were asked to solve on a timed, standardized test, and suppose that it was your group's math ability that was negatively stereotyped in the larger society. In other words, suppose you were an American woman showing up for an experiment involving difficult math. With a stereotype threat that is a contingency of your gender identity in math-related settings be enough to interfere with your performance on the test? Would you be able to just push through this threat of being seen stereotypically and perform well anyway? Or would the very effort to push hard on a timed test be distracting enough to impair your performance despite the extra effort? Would you experience this threat, this contingency of identity, every time you tried difficult math in settings with males around? Would this contingency of identity in math settings become frustrating enough to make you avoid math-related college majors and careers? Would women living in a society where women's math ability is not negatively stereotyped experience this threat? Would their scores be better? Or suppose the test you were asked to take wasn't the Michigan Athletic Aptitude Test, but was the SAT. And suppose the negative stereotype about your group wasn't about athletic ability, or even about math ability alone, but about scholastic ability in general. Again, would the stereotype threat you experience as a contingency of your identity in scholastic settings be enough to interfere with your performance on this test? Does the threat cause this interference by diverting mental resources away from the test and onto your worries? Would the stereotype threat you experience in scholastic settings affect other experiences as well, such as your classroom performance and your comfort interacting with teachers, professors, teaching assistants, and even other students not in your group? Would this contingency of identity make these settings so frustrating for you that you might try to avoid them in choosing a walk of life? The purpose of this audiobook is to describe the journey that my colleagues and I have taken in formulating these and related questions and then in systematically trying to answer them over the past 20 years. The experience has been like trying to solve a mystery. And the approach of the audiobook is to give you an over-the-shoulder view of how that mystery has unfolded, of the progression of ideas and revelations, often from the research itself, about the surprising ways that stereotypes affect us. Our intellectual functioning, our stress reactions, the tension that can exist between people from different groups, and the sometimes very surprising strategies that alleviate these effects and thereby help solve some of society's worst problems. And because science is rarely a solitary activity anymore, something long true for me, the story also describes many of the people who have done this research, as well as how they work. You will also meet many interesting people who have experienced this threat, including a famous journalist, an African-American expatriate in Paris, a person who rose from sharecropping to wealth in rural North Carolina, students at some of America's most elite universities, and students in some of America's most wanting K-12 schools. Although the audiobook deals with issues that can have a political charge, neither it nor the work it reports is propelled by an ideological orientation, to the best of my and my colleagues' ability. One of the first things one learns as a social psychologist is that everyone is capable of bias. We simply are not and cannot be all-knowing and completely objective. Our understandings and views of the world are partial and reflect the circumstances of our particular lives. This is where a discipline like science comes in. It doesn't purge us of bias, but it extends what we can see and understand while constraining bias. That is where I would stake my claim, at any rate. The constant back and forth between ideas and research results hammers away at bias, and just as important, often reveals aspects of reality that surpass our original ideas and insights. When that has happened, and it has, that is the direction our research goes in. I would like to see my strongest convictions as arising from that kind of revelation, not from prior belief, and I hope you will get a view of that experience as you read along. Arising this way, several generation patterns of findings have persistently emerged in this research. Seeing these patterns, more than any ideas or hunches I began this research with, has convinced me of the importance of identity contingencies and identity threat in our lives. The first pattern is that despite the strong sense we have of ourselves as autonomous individuals, evidence consistently shows that contingencies tied to our social identities do make a difference in shaping our lives, from the way we perform in certain situations to the careers and friends we choose. As the white world-class sprinter takes the starting blocks in the 100-meter dash at the Olympic trials, he is as autonomous an individual as the black sprinters next to him, and they all face precisely the same 100 meters of free and open track. Nonetheless, in order to do well in that situation, research suggests that he may have to surmount a pressure tied to his racial identity that the black sprinters don't face. The second dimension of reality, long evident in our research, is that identity threats and the damage they can do to our functioning play an important role in some of society's most important social problems. These range from the racial, social class, and gender achievement gaps that persistently plague and distort our society to the equally persistent intergroup tensions that often trouble our social relations. Third, also coming to light in this research is a general process involving the allocation of mental resources and even a precise pattern of brain activation by which these threats impair a broad range of human functioning. Something like a unifying understanding of how these threats have their effect is emerging. Finally, a set of things we can do as individuals to reduce the impact of these threats in our own lives, as well as what we as a society can do to reduce their impact in important places like schools and workplaces, has come to light. There is truly inspirational news here, evidence that often small, feasible things done to reduce these threats in schools and classrooms can dramatically reduce the racial and gender achievement gaps that so discouragingly characterize our society. These findings have convinced me of the importance of understanding identity threat to our personal progress and areas of great concern like achievement and better group relations, and to societal progress in achieving the identity-integrated civil life and equal opportunity that is a founding dream of this society. This audiobook presents the journey that my colleagues and I have taken in getting to this conviction. Let's begin the journey where it began, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 1987. Chapter 2. A Mysterious Link Between Identity and Intellectual Performance. 1. In the spring of 1986, when I was a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle, the University of Michigan offered me a job with two parts. The first part was to be a social psychologist, just as I had been at the University of Washington. I was gratified. The University of Michigan had, and still has, one of the nation's leading graduate programs in social psychology. The second part was to direct an academic support program for minority students. I was attracted to this, too. An interest in the psychological issues surrounding the education of minority students had helped steer me into social psychology. But I worried. How would the real-time duties of running a student program affect my research? I visited the program twice to find out. My second visit to Ann Arbor, toward the end of a steamy July, when the sidewalks radiated heat, proved decisive. I could see how big the program was. It served the advising, tutoring, and financial management needs of over 400 students, and it did so within a large bureaucracy, the kind it takes to run a university of 36,000 students. I knew quickly on the second visit that I wouldn't take the job. I would have had to stop being a researcher, and I wasn't close to being ready for that. So I knew what to do, but I also knew, as I flew home, that something had changed for me, that seeing the program had caused a realignment of interests. What I'd seen, I felt, was a core American struggle, an institution trying to integrate itself, racially, ethnically, class-wise. The program staff and faculty had a mission. They were helping students from underrepresented backgrounds be effective on a demanding campus, one that, for example, had been racially integrated to any meaningful degree for only 20 or so years of its 170-year history. My research life, my intellectual life, I knew from this visit, would be headed in a different direction. Two things, I believe, triggered the change. The first was a new vantage point on a familiar problem, the academic struggles of too many minority students on American college campuses. My Ann Arbor visit made me aware that I had a certain perspective on this problem, that I wasn't neutral. When it came to college student life, I was on the outside looking in, an observer. If asked to explain the academic difficulties of any students, I would, like most professors, have stressed what was in my observer's line of vision and in my psychologist's toolbox. The students themselves, their motivations, expectations, self-esteem, cultural orientation, the value they placed on education, their work habits, their academic skills and knowledge, their family's emphasis on school achievement, and so forth. Some years ago, two social psychologists, Edward Jones and Richard Nisbet, argued that when it comes to explaining people's behavior, something like achievement problems, for example, there's a big difference between the observer's perspective, the perspective of a person observing the behavior, and the actor's perspective, the perspective of a person doing the behavior. As observers, Jones and Nisbet said, we're looking at the actor, the person doing the behavior we are trying to explain. Thus, the actor dominates our literal and mental visual field, which makes the circumstances to which he is responding less visible to us. And the resulting picture in our minds, the actor sticks out like a sore thumb, and the circumstances to which he is responding are obscured from view. Jones and Nisbet held that this picture causes a bias when we try to explain the actor's behavior. We emphasize the things we can see. We emphasize things about the actor, characteristics, traits, and so on, that seem like plausible explanations for her behavior. And we de-emphasize, as causes of her behavior, the things we can't see very well, namely the circumstances to which she is adapting. My second visit to Ann Arbor made me aware of what should have been obvious. I had become an observer of minority students and their achievement struggles. I arrived in Ann Arbor implicitly looking for what the students might be doing or what characteristics they might have that held back their achievement. But on the visit, I talked to minority students themselves, the actors in the drama of their achievement struggles. They said nothing about expectations, motivation, the value their families placed on education, not even when I pointedly asked them about these things. They were proud to be students at such a strong university. Their families were proud of them. They had been successful in high school. If they brought low expectations with them, they didn't show them to me. They talked about the university environment. They talked about being a small social minority. They described needing a space where they weren't made so aware of being a minority. They worried that teaching assistants, Fellow students and even faculty might see their academic abilities as less than those of other students. They described how social life was organized by race, ethnicity, social class. They had few close friends across group lines. They felt that black styles, preferences, and interests were marginalized on campus, sometimes even stigmatized. They noted the small number of black or minority faculty. They could have been making excuses. I couldn't know. They seemed earnest, matter-of-fact, not accusatory, but they did seem worried that Michigan was not the right place for them. The second striking thing I saw on this trip was a graph depicting student grades. It was my first glimpse of an important fact, that the academic troubles of black students at Michigan, and they were indeed having academic troubles, were not entirely due to weaker academic skills and motivations. After forming groups of Michigan graduates for a period of several years on the basis of the SAT score they had when they entered Michigan, the graph showed the average grades each of these groups got. Thus, one could see the college grades for students who entered Michigan with SATs between 1,000 and 1,050, between 1,050 and 1,100, all the way up to those who entered the SATs between 1,550 and 1,600, then the top of the SAT scale. The graph showed a modest tendency for students with higher SATs to get higher grades. No surprise. The SAT is designed to predict college grades, even though, for this sample of students, the tendency for students with higher SATs to get higher college grades wasn't that strong. What struck me was something else. To show how black students had done, the graph presented a separate line for black Michigan graduates during the same period. This line showed that black students with stronger entering SATs also graduated with slightly higher grades. Again, no surprise, except for one thing. The line for black students was consistently lower than the line for other students. At every level of entering SATs, even the highest level, black students got lower grades than other students. If we assume the SAT is a rough measure of preparation for college, this meant something dramatic, that among students with comparable academic skills, as measured by the SAT, black students got less of a return on those skills in college than other students. Something was suppressing the yield they got from their skills. The Ann Arbor trip raised questions and provided some clues. There was hard evidence. The achievement problems of black students at Michigan weren't caused entirely by skill deficits. Something about the social and psychological aspects of their experience was likely involved. At the time, I had no idea what it was. There was softer evidence. The students themselves worried about whether or not they belonged, or ever could belong, at Michigan. Martin Luther King once worried that black students in integrated schools might not always be taught by people who loved them. These students had the same concern. I wondered on that flight home whether these two pieces of evidence, about their grades and about their sense of belonging, had anything to do with each other. 2. A year later, Michigan offered me a professorship in psychology, a chance to pursue my research interests without administering a larger bureaucracy. I was excited. I knew that if I went, intriguing and important questions awaited. Families can be gracious, and mine certainly was on this occasion. In the fall of 1987, despite the uprooting of two teenagers that it required, my family and I landed in Ann Arbor just in time for the new school year and Michigan football. Almost immediately, as if on signal, the graph showing black student underperformance at Michigan reappeared in my life. I was appointed to a university-wide committee on minority student retention and recruitment, and there again, and material handed out on the first day the committee met, was the graph showing the underperformance of black students, which was the chief rationale for this committee. Richard Nisbet, another Michigan social psychologist, the same person who came up with the actor observer difference, and I began talking about this underperformance. Nisbet is a great conversationalist, and not just idly so. He uses conversations to shape a scientific inquiry to help him link up questions so that they have a narrative form. He starts in on a problem by trying to see how it works in real life. He interviews people. He surveys people over the phone. He snoops in archival records. He reads broadly. He triangulates on an understanding. Eventually, he does formal experiments to test that understanding and to take the phenomenon further apart to see how it works. Inspired by this approach, I suppressed my normal tendency to proceed quickly to the laboratory. I kept talking to students. I designed a seminar on the topic of underperformance. I remember that students in the seminar turned up a surprising fact. They stopped a number of black and white students as they crossed campus and asked them to complete a 4 or 5 page questionnaire. They wanted to find out how many close friends of a different race students had. The first page of the questionnaire asked students to list their 6 best friends, and the last page asked them to record their race. This was so that a possible friend's race couldn't influence whether or not he or she was included on the list of close friends. The survey revealed that among their 6 closest friends, neither white nor black students averaged even 1 friend from the other racial group. Blacks, for example, averaged only 2/3 of a white friend among their top 6 friends. As students had been telling me, their social networks were organized by race. I continued to look at grade records. I wanted to see how common black student underperformance was across the curriculum. Sadly, it was everywhere, from English to math to psychology. As some comfort to the University of Michigan, my reading soon revealed that black student underperformance was a national phenomenon. It happened throughout the education system, in college classes, in medical schools, in law schools, in business schools, and often in K-12 schooling. It was so common and predictable as to be nearly lawful. People who made tests had long known about this phenomenon. They also knew that it happens to more groups than just blacks. It happens to Latinos, Native Americans, and to women in advanced college math classes, law schools, medical schools, and business schools. This is, of course, an unhappy fact, and standing at the ready, I found many explanations, largely from the observer's perspective, that these students lack the motivation or cultural knowledge or skills to succeed at more difficult coursework, where underperformance tends to occur, or that they somehow self-destruct because of low self-expectations or low self-esteem picked up from the broader culture, or even from their own families and communities. These accounts weren't implausible, if not entirely handsome. I had to keep them on the table of possibilities, but I had doubts. Could they fully explain the occurrence of underperformance in so many groups, at so many levels and types of schooling? Nor could I shake a suspicion that, to a larger extent than I and others had realized, underperformance had something to do with what underperforming groups were experiencing in school. Something was causing their strengths to let them down consistently, even the strongest among them. Something in the air on campus seemed part of their problems. 3. A few years later, I was invited to give a talk on my research at a small, distinguished liberal arts college in the Northeast. The school also took the occasion to consult me about the progress of their minority students, which, in the early 1990s, meant largely black students. This would turn out to be something I did often in the years to come. Invariably, I learned a lot on these trips. They always edified, showing me things about the problems I was working on that I hadn't understood before. This early trip was especially interesting. I talked to black student groups and to faculty and administrators in rapid succession, a dramatic display of different perspectives. The faculty and administrators worried about the problems of black students: lower grade performance, greater likelihood of dropping out, a greater tendency to downgrade their professional ambitions as their schooling went on, a tendency to avoid quantitatively based fields, less social integration into campus life, significantly segregated friendship networks, and so on. Their list was nearly identical to the list drawn up by the Michigan Recruitment and Retention Committee. We talked in a small conference room paneled in light maple. One entire wall was floor-to-ceiling windows that brought in slants of early spring light and the sight of patchy snow in the woods outside. The atmosphere was friendly, even warm, but also serious, careful, conducive to a trusting conversation among the adults. These were busy people. The problems of black students on this privileged campus weren't their only concerns. They wanted their school to work well, however, and to work well for everyone. They used primarily observer theories to understand these problems. Were they admitting the right students? Should they weigh academic skills even more heavily in admissions? Was family background critical? They hadn't heard of the underperformance phenomenon. They weren't sure about its implication that the problems of these students weren't entirely academic. I also felt a presence in the room during the faculty and administrator meetings. It was as if a flame burned in the corner. The flame was the possibility that, inadvertently, they might do something or condone something that could be seen as racist. It was a searing flame. They didn't want to get close to it. They wanted me to talk. Did I have any ideas? The black students, for their part, were distressed. I met them in a long, narrow, low-ceilinged room on the first floor of a campus house that had been converted to student service offices and meeting rooms. Students crowded in for the session, probably 75 or so in number, a fair portion of their population on this small campus. They wanted me to talk too, but mainly they wanted to talk. They wanted to describe their experience at the college, the stress they felt. They said that too much of the time they felt that they didn't belong. They said they were unhappy a lot of the time. They often went home on weekends. Did I have any ideas? Sometimes black students said the school had racist elements. They fanned the flame. They would cite an incident with a teaching assistant, a comment by a professor or fellow student. But as the day went on and I got to look over their shoulders more, take the actor's perspective, it seemed to me that they were affected more by the ways campus life was racially organized than by the racism of particular people. There was, for example, their sense of marginalization. They were a small minority on campus. Campus culture, its ideas of who and what were cool, its prevailing values, social norms, preferences, modes of dress, images of beauty, musical preferences, modes of religious expression, and the like, was dominated by whites, the most numerous group on campus and the group most historically identified with the school. Against this backdrop, black students worried about belonging, about whether they could find a valued place in campus life. Could they be valued for who they were in this setting? Would they be seen as socially desirable? Numbers played a big role in this sense of marginalization. The cultural domination of whites followed from their numbers. Friendships and social life were also significantly organized by race. Black students were clearly party to this, even as they seemed to sense its cost. Over 85% of Americans, for example, get their jobs through acquaintance contacts. Racially homogeneous friendship networks can segregate people out of important networks and thus out of important opportunities. They also noted the small number of black faculty and administrators. Was this irrelevant? Did it say something about the possibility of their belonging on this campus? The sociologist William Julius Wilson has explained the creation and maintenance of large African-American ghettos in northern cities as due to a concentration of factors, such as the long period of migration of blacks from the south to the north, inadequate and poorly funded public schools, the movement of jobs outside of the cities and to foreign countries, job discrimination, and geographic and social isolation. These things combine, in the philosopher Charles Mills' term, to downwardly constitute people living in ghettos, to so disadvantage them as to make them less effective agents in their own behalf. This tidy, well-off college was no racial ghetto, and the factors that downwardly constitute black students there were less commonly understood than factors like distance from jobs or discrimination. But listening to these students, it seemed that a concentration of factors provided a better way to understand what might be causing their underperformance. The major standing explanation seemed incomplete. Underperformance didn't seem to be fully explained by racism on the part of teachers and fellow students. The instances of possible racism that black students described weren't nearly as lawful and widespread as their underperformance. Nor did it seem to be caused simply by motivational or cultural deficits that black students brought with them. These students were the academic vanguard of their group, for the most part, selected against the highest academic standards. Rather, a concentration of factors seemed to be involved. A concentration of racialized aspects of campus life. racial marginalization, racial segregation of social and academic networks, group underrepresentation in important campus roles, even a racial organization of curriculum choices, all reflecting, to some degree, the racial organization of the larger society. This seemed like a reasonable hunch. Still, as I said, these weren't hard factors like unemployment and unequal school financing. They were dimensions of social organization. How bad could they be? Could they really be powerful enough to interfere with grade performance of black students, especially of black students very likely reared with the value of trying twice as hard in the face of racial adversity? 4. On April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. On the next day, a third grade teacher in Iowa named Jane Elliott was looking for a way to show her class the importance of Dr. King's life and work. She lived in Riceville, Iowa, a small farming community with a population so homogeneous that many of her students had never seen an African American. To show them the experience of being discriminated against, she divided her class into brown-eyed and blue-eyed students. On the first day, she discriminated against the brown-eyed students. She put felt collars around their necks to identify them. She said that blue-eyed students were smarter, cleaner, and better behaved than brown-eyed students. She gave blue-eyed students seats in the front of the classroom and first dibs on playground equipment during recess. She encouraged the blue-eyed students not to associate with the brown-eyed students in class or on the playground. She gave blue-eyed students first access to lessons and materials used in the lessons. The entire exercise was eventually reenacted and made into an ABC News documentary entitled The Eye of the Storm. Even in the reenactment, the emotion on the faces of the brown-eyed students on that first day was upsetting. You knew this exercise wouldn't be repeated much. The students were humiliated. They huddled together on the playground, coat collars turned up to hide their faces from the documentary's camera. They said almost nothing in class and barely spoke all day. The blue-eyed students, meanwhile, were relaxed, happy, unself-conscious participants in class. On the second day, Miss Elliott turned the tables. She put the felt collars around the necks of the blue-eyed students and treated them the same way she treated the brown-eyed students the day before. The blue-eyed students now lost the energy they'd had the day before and behaved the way the brown-eyed students had on that day, huddled and downcast. The brown-eyed students, for their part, were once again eager learners. Tucked away in this documentary are several scenes showing a fascinating intellectual implication of Miss Elliott's experiment. These are the scenes in which she gives arithmetic and spelling lessons to small groups of students. They show how poorly the stigmatized students did. They barely paid attention. They receded to the back of even these small groups. They spoke only if spoken to. They didn't remember the instructions. They were slow to respond. They got a lot of answers wrong. But on the day they were not stigmatized, these same students responded like the exuberant, cognitively adept children they apparently were. The environment and their status in it seemed to be an actual component of their ability. Miss Elliott deliberately set out to downwardly constitute her students temporarily. She was making a point. The college I visited was not making a point. It did not purposely set out to do things that would downwardly constitute black students. Quite the contrary. It saw itself as committed to their inclusion. The school was bewildered by the problems that followed that inclusion. But after I thought about the group underperformance for a number of years and talked to countless students along the way, two things occurred to me. First, like many institutions of higher education in the United States, this school had inherited a social organization from the larger society and from its own history that might well place black students under downwardly constituting pressures. Powerful pressures not well understood within the traditional frameworks of prejudice and racism on the one hand, or student deficits on the other. Second, these downwardly constituting pressures might have the power to interfere directly and indirectly with intellectual performance. That is, they might have the power to cause underperformance. 5. By this time, I was working with a University of Michigan graduate student named Stephen Spencer, now a distinguished professor at the University of Waterloo. Steve is a high-energy, enthusiastic person. He grew up on a Michigan farm. He knows how to throw himself into things. He loves to talk psychology. He is quick and incisive. We had been working on the question of how people maintain a perception of personal adequacy in the face of information that could threaten that perception. The effort to do this, we theorized, is a major driver of mental life, causing us to re-examine our beliefs and assumptions, to reintegrate understandings, sometimes even to prod growth. Our approach to understanding these questions had earlier been pulled together in a theory of self-affirmation. That theory, and an unrelated but equally interesting theory of how the pharmacological and psychological effects of alcohol could foster alcohol addiction, had been the foci of my research at the University of Washington. These were captivating problems, fun to work on. Steve and I, along with Robert Josephs, another graduate student at the time, now a distinguished professor at the University of Texas, were making great progress in both areas. But for some reason, at this new university, it was the problem of group underperformance that had begun to preoccupy me. I kibitzed and kibitzed about it, and eventually, as I had hoped, Steve began to pick up this preoccupation too. Despite the image of science as a formal and prescribed affair, scientific inquiries have choice points, places where the investigator has to decide what to do next without much formal guidance. Intuition and best guesses come into play. We needed a better look at what caused underperformance, and my best hunch was that it was stigmatization, the downward constitution that some groups might experience in a school environment. Of course, underperformance could just as well come from something about the group itself. I favored the stigmatization idea. I confess that I liked it better than the idea that underperformance was rooted in some biological difference between groups. To me, a discouraging and potentially dehumanizing idea. But there was also the fact that scholastic underperformance happened in several groups. Blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, women, and math classes. Could there be something biological about all of these groups that caused them to underperform? Possibly. But I could also imagine that these groups shared an experience of stigmatization. Different in form, of course, but nonetheless, a group-based stigmatization in precisely those areas where they underperformed. A reasonable inference, but only an inference. I knew it was time to test this idea. To do this, Steve and I needed a situation like Jane Elliott's classroom. We had to compare a group's intellectual performance when its members were stigmatized with their intellectual performance when they were not stigmatized, like comparing the blue-eyed student's performance on the day they wore collars and were seated in the back of the classroom with their performance on the day they wore no collars and were seated up front. If the group members underperformed when they were stigmatized, but not when they were not stigmatized, we'd have evidence that stigmatization alone, a devalued social status, had the capacity to impair intellectual performance. It soon occurred to us that a natural experiment of precisely this sort might be going on in our own backyard, the college classroom, specifically in the different experiences of women in math-oriented versus humanities-oriented classes. Considerable research shows that in math classes, especially at the college level, and especially in more advanced classes, women report feeling what the sociologist Nancy Hewitt and Elaine Seymour called a chilly climate. That is, they feel their abilities are under suspicion, that feminine characteristics discredit their seriousness, that they have to prove themselves constantly, that their career commitment is questioned, and so on. Yet in English classes, and in humanities classes more generally, women report fewer such pressures, even in advanced coursework. Steve and I weren't focused on the question of why these differences exist. This audiobook returns to that question at various points. At the time, though, he and I were focused on a simpler idea, the natural experiment this situation would allow. We would compare how much women underperformed in advanced math classes, where they reported feeling more stigmatization from a chilly climate, with how much they underperformed in advanced English classes, where they reported feeling considerably less stigmatization of their abilities. The experiment was just that simple. If stigmatization can impair intellectual performance, as Steve and I were guessing, then women in advanced math classes should underperform more than women in advanced English classes. That is, the gap between women's and men's grades should be greater in advanced math classes than in advanced English classes. The data we could assemble were less than perfect. It is important to stress that once the data were assembled,